You're listening to 830 AM KSDP in Sandpoint, Alaska, K201DA in King Cove, Alaska.
Thanks Leadership Circle advocate Jan Whitefield for making a financial investment in the cause of a more informed and connected Alaska.
Welcome to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Twilla. Every year, thousands of hawks and other raptors migrate into south central Alaska by Gunsight Mountain on the Glen Highway. Red-tailed hawks, rough-legged hawks, northern harriers, golden eagles, sharp-shinned hawks, merlins, and peregrine falcons are some of the many species of birds that traverse the zone. Anchorage Audubon and the Mat-Su birders host the annual Hawk Watch tailgate every mid-April, with talks about how to identify the birds as they zoom overhead. Bob Diedrich and Ted Swim join me to share the history of Hawk Watch and why the Gunsight Mountain location is a magnet for hawk migration. In the second half of the show, I visit with professional birders working with Hawk Watch International. Stay tuned for Outdoor Explorer.
You're listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1.
The Anchorage Opera presents The Italian Girl in Algiers, April 24th, 26th, and 27th at the Sidney Lawrence Theater. Isabella is in love with Lindoro, who has been unintentionally retained as a valet aboard a cruise ship by Mustafa, who is married to Elvira, but is in love with Isabella. It's hijinks on the high seas, Rossini style. Tickets at 907-263-ARTS or by visiting anchorageopera.org. This message sponsored by Anchorage Opera.
Welcome to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Twilla. We're talking about Hawk Watch, which is an event on migration of birds up by Gunsight Mountain, north of Palmer. Today in the studio, I have Bob Diedrich, and on Zoom, I have Ted Swim. Bob, let's start with you. Talk us a little bit about yourself, like how you got into birding, and your sort of history with this event a little bit.
Okay, when I got out of college, I was a naturalist back east, and we did birding programs as part of the naturalist program back there, and that's when I really started getting into birding. While that was happening, I met Ted back there in Virginia doing hawk work with somebody that became very important in both of our lives, and we got together and started doing raptor things together back east in Virginia in the early 70s.
And then you ended up in Alaska. How'd that happen?
Well, I ended up coming up here on a wilderness trip, and like a lot of people that come to Alaska doing the sorts of things like that, I wanted to stay and didn't leave.
Yeah.
So, well, I worked for state parks for a while, and then I started a business taking people out looking for birds in the wilderness.
Yeah, yeah. And I've had great encounters with you along the way, random encounters. And you have some famous birder with you. Seems like they all came to Bob. Ted, how about you? How did you get into birding, and how did you end up in Alaska?
Well, I grew up in a house full of bird books and wildlife art, and both my parents loved birds, and I guess I just got the bug from them when I was a kid. And like Bob, we both met the same guy, Bill Clark, in Northern Virginia, and he introduced us to doing field work and trying to collect data and insight into raptors, hawks, and owls. And then Bob and I both helped trap and band raptors during fall migration at Cape May, New Jersey for years, and we both got the bug. And we both ended up in Alaska and were roommates off and on for years and collaborated. To this day, we still collaborate on field work, going out and looking at birds, as well as pursuing raptors and collecting data on them, catching them and banding them. And we've been doing it since, as Bob said, the early 70s.
And Ted, what was your career, if I may ask?
I worked for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service after a number of years of temporary work, working for BLM and the National Park Service, doing bird surveys, particularly for raptors, but going to different parts of the state and working on the North Slope. And I, but is also Bob and his wife, Lisa Moorhead, did peregrine surveys for the Fish and Wildlife Service on the North Slope. And all of that just increased my appreciation for raptors and working on them and collecting information and insight about them.
Why raptors? There's a lot of different species of birds out there. I know you're both into all of them, but what was fascinating about raptors for you, Ted?
Well, they're just pretty spectacular animals. And I'm quite fascinated by many other groups of birds too, but I did get work associated with raptors because peregrine falcons were endangered in the 70s under the and protected under the Endangered Species Act. And so the Fish and Wildlife Service and other agencies and parties were engaged in doing inventories, trying to determine where we had peregrines in Alaska, what their trends were, how they were responding to restrictions on the use of pesticides, which had caused their decline. So there was work there, but they are fascinating animals and quite beautiful, amazing flyers. And some of them are highly migratory, and that's fairly interesting too. So I just got sucked into that, I guess.
And Bob?
Well, you know, when we were back in the East, we were both interested in all kinds of different birds, and I got involved in banding through the nature centers that I was working for, mostly songbird banding. And when I met Ted, he was heading out with this Bill Clark to go do some raptor stuff. And I quickly realized that working with the raptors was a lot more exciting than taking songbirds out of a mist net that just kind of happened to fly into them. Because when you're out working and trying to ban raptors, you're active and trying to interact with them and, you know, outsmart them enough to catch them and then get to, you know, handle these things that are just something to behold, you know, because you, they have these dangerous feet and dangerous bills, and it was just really exciting. So the raptors have an, to me, an excitement element that some of the other birds don't when you're doing field research on them.
We're catching raptors. How would one do that?
Well, that's kind of a long story, and there's a lot of different techniques. But Ted mentioned that we did a lot of banding up at Cape May, New Jersey. We actually helped set up that Cape May Bird Observatory. And that included being in blinds, several different blinds up there, and there's a huge number migrating through Cape May, New Jersey. So we sit in blinds and attract them in to our station and catch them in a blind like that. And then, you know, when it's not the fall banding or migration time, we would go what we call out road trapping, where we'd drive the roads around where we lived or on the places where they wintered more and try and catch them out of cars.
Wow.
with different techniques. And we brought that interest up here to Alaska and did that up here as well, which sort of plays into what we were
so
doing.
Like driving a car? Like
Well, yes. When we were doing it up here, we were really interested in trying to catch hawk owls because there were quite a few of them that would be in the wintertime and in the springtime out the Glen Highway out there, and they were pretty easy to catch. So we could go out on a weekend and get 9 or 10 of them.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And we realized that there was some other fun stuff, rafter-wise, that was going on in the spring because they were migrating up. So we came up with some techniques for trying to catch some of those too, some of which were old-time techniques that were developed by falconers and some of them that we kind of came up with ourselves. And we came up with a couple of clever ideas, I think, don't you, Ted?
Or at least, yeah, played off of some things that some people had done in Canada and stuff too. So
yeah,
it was very fun.
That sounds fun. So let's talk about Hawk Watch now and that event. How'd that come about? How'd you find that spot? And tell us about that location.
We were doing this road trapping, you know, we'd go out for a weekend and stuff, and ended up taking people with us. And I was out doing that and had Cliff Ames with me.
Oh, yeah.
And he needs to get a little of the credit for this, because we were out camping and kind of just moving down the Glen Highway, and we got to mile 118, and he said, you know, I used to come out here skiing all the time, and right at this spot, we used to see rafters all the time when we were skiing here. And I sort of made a note of that, and Ted and I talked about it. And when we were looking for a place that we could watch, you know, and see concentrations of them, or maybe even a possibility of a place where we could band them, we decided to take a look at several places along the Glen Highway there, and that was one of the places because of what Cliff had said.
Does that ring true to you, Ted?
Yeah, and exactly what Bob said. We drove back and forth through that valley many times, both spring and fall, and we had started to see quite a few birds moving through there. And I had forgotten the Cliff Ames contribution, and but in the very early 80s we started seeing that there were birds between Glen Allen and Gunsight Mountain moving in late March, but mostly April, and we'd see harriers, harlins, hawks, rough-legged hawks, these other migrants that had been gone all winter. We'd see them moving through, and then we started focusing on the area near Gunsight and between there and Sheep Mountain, and kind of going back and forth looking for specific spots that seemed to have the topographic features that concentrated the birds. And so we spent quite a bit of time standing on the side of the highway with our binoculars and just watching and trying to figure out where the funnel got more concentrated, the birds moving through, and what weather conditions we could find them under, and what species we were seeing, and if you went in either direction on the highway, how it affected the number of birds that we saw, their height above the ground, their distance off the highway, et cetera. So we started trying to be students of what we were seeing and refine where we went and when we would go there and how to look to try to catch the birds moving past. To see them moving past.
Yeah. And then you narrowed it down to this one spot or a couple of spots right by Gunsight, correct?
Yeah, and then we would go out, you know, recreationally on weekends with friends, you know, just Ted and I, if there wasn't anybody else interested, but we'd get friends to go, and it got to be kind of a little tailgate party, you know, yeah, with our friends a couple times a year sort of thing. And then, you know, we just realized this is a phenomena that we need to kind of share with the community. So we decided it was time to kind of make it public and try and get Audubon involved and start letting other people see what we were seeing.
That's like, what, mile 120-something?
118.
118. What about that spot makes it unique? What makes it funnel the birds through there?
Ted, why don't you take that one?
When raptors are migrating into the state in spring, well, let me take a step back. There are a couple of features on the landscape that tend to funnel birds migrating. One are what are called leading lines, which are just natural features on the landscape that provide a bird sort of a guide that makes it easy for them to follow. And in some cases, leading lines can also provide thermals, which provides uplift to birds that like to increase their height above the ground and then convert that into energy or motion by dropping down in the direction they want to fly and then get another thermal and go back up. Alternately, topographic features, if there's a light wind moving over the surface of the earth, that can hit topographic features and is deflected upward, causing what is called orographic lift, and birds can gain a benefit from that. Other features that affect how and where birds migrate are barriers. If there's open water, many species don't like to fly over it. It comes with risk. It may be devoid of foraging habitat or escape cover if a predator chases them or whatever. And it may provide no habitat that's suitable for perching and resting or foraging or anything else. So birds tend to avoid oceans or very large expanses of open water like the Great Lakes. and they may be drawn towards smallish topographic features that provide that orographic lift, or open dark areas that provide thermals, with warm air being heated by, or air being heated by sunlight and then rising up again, giving a bird a free lift up. These raptors are migrating into Alaska in the spring. The ground is largely snow covered, so there's not very many dark areas that create thermals. So they tend to use topographic features that provide orographic lift. On the other hand, they tend to move in what bird people call the intermountain trenches, trying to avoid the high country, because high country can have really, really bad weather. It can be foggy or cloudy up there. And furthermore, there's deep snow. There may be no food resources, no trees to perch on or whatever. So the birds tend to follow valleys or go through narrow throats to avoid high mountains. So when these raptors are coming in, they're moving across a broad front in Western Canada. And if and when they hit mountain ranges, they tend to funnel through the trenches and follow some of the valleys. And so what we see in that valley is those birds, if you go east from Gunsight Mountain, the migration is very broad and spread out. Between Glen Allen and Gunsight Mountain, you can't really get in a thick stream of birds where you see bird after bird going past. But as those birds are proceeding westward towards Gunsight Mountain, the valley starts to constrict. There's mountains to the south, there's mountains to the north, and they get kind of funneled into a narrower stream. And then there's that nice ridge just kind of to the northwest, I guess, of Gunsight Mountain that gives them some topographic lift. So some of the birds remain out over the valley, but some get right on that ridge that's above the pullouts where the Hawk Watch is done by Hawk Watch International, or the tailgate party that Bob is talking about. So they get funneled into a much narrower stream, and they're not that high above the ground because there's no thermals shooting them up thousands of feet above the ground, because there's just not bare ground yet creating that convection zone.
You're listening to Alaska Public Media and Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Torda. We're talking about Hawk Watch and hawk migration with Bob Dittrich and Ted Swim. Thanks, Ted, for that description. That was a great description of why the birds are focused in there. Bob, anything to add to that?
Well, I think that was a pretty thorough description of why they're in there. But as far as the tailgate party goes, we commonly get 100 cars up there on the Audubon weekends, which is actually it started out as an Anchorage Audubon Saturday or Sunday, and it's morphed into a 2-day weekend with the Matsu birders sponsoring Sunday, and those two groups are financing the porta potties, which is the big expense out there. So it's a 2-day event with Saturday the Anchorage Audubon and Sunday the Matsu birders tailgate party, where they bring the charcoal grills, and it ends up being a more of a real tailgate party when on Sunday.
What are some of the highlights for you guys over the years?
Well, the birds are the birds and the weather. It's become a rite of spring out there, because you get out there and you're really some of the earliest encounters of birds in the year coming in, and a chance to see some birds you don't often see too out there, not just the raptors, but you know, snow bunnies and things like that that are also migrating down the road. But what Gunside Mountain is really kind of famous for is red-tailed hawk has several kind of morphs, color morphs, and one of them is the Harlan's hawk, which it used to be considered a species, and now it's lumped with the red tails, and there's some people that want to split it back out into another species again. So there's a lot of birders arguing about all that kind of stuff. But it's one of the rarer color morphs of the red tail, and this is by far the largest concentration of that particular species that morph anywhere they're watching hawks. So that's our attraction that we can brag about that is different than everybody else. That and the number of golden eagles, I guess I should say. There is a huge number of golden eagles coming through that area.
Like how many on a day, you know? Like, what are we talking?
I think they've had 260 in a day.
Oh, wow.
That was, you know, that was huge. But they'll go several days where they're getting 20, 30, 50, 60. They don't get that in other hawk watches like that.
That's I didn't always highlight for me the numbers of birds. And this last year, it seemed like the day I was there, it was Northern Harriers, like 90 of them, just really impressive.
I think we had 117 on the hawk watch day this year.
And Bob, you do for beginners, it's open for everybody, and it's free. You do a little ID, right?
Yeah, I do. Do a lecture and put up my little visual aids there that are now, I think, 30 years old.
But still work.
But still work. Yeah. And I try and do a little identification thing for it. It's, you know, most of the people have been coming for years, so they got it down pretty good, but it's always good to kind of review.
And we're recording this in the spring of 2024, but the event's usually mid-April, right?
Yeah.
Well, I was going to add one thing. Bob was absolutely correct saying the Harlan's hawks and golden eagles are real features, but I would add that there's one other thing that's kind of unusual. Because the ground is still snow-covered when these birds are going over, and because some of the people don't have a lot of experience differentiating among these species, and some of the identifying features are fairly subtle, what happens is the birds are illuminated exceptionally well from below because the sun is hitting the snow and reflecting upward. And so you can look at an awful lot of raptors in a lot of different places, and regularly that place has the best viewing in the places that I've been to because there's so much light. It's so sunny and clear usually, and all that light is reflecting upward and just illuminating those features. So Bob and Lisa give their talk, they describe the different characteristics, and then when you see them, you don't just see them, you see them exquisitely well lit up, and you can just see the minutiae of what those characteristics are that help you differentiate among the species.
Does the weather affect the numbers?
Hugely. Yeah, I generally, you know, if you have a sunny day, you're going to have the thermals and the uplifts and that kind of thing that really kind of crank them up to get moving. And, you know, if it's windy and cold, that's not happening so much. And if it's really bad, they'll even maybe take a day off and just hunt for a while, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, say they want favorable winds because they're going long distances, and they need to keep their energy.
Right.
And so they go when it's easy. And when they get these thermals and can get up high and then, like Ted described, start going down, they gain speed and momentum, get another thermal and go back up and just do the same thing, and can go long distances without flapping. You know, they just can travel.
That's so cool. Ted, we talked a little bit earlier, before we started, about just general migration patterns. Where are these birds coming from, and you know, what's going on with their migration that we know of?
Well, I'd say that in general, a lot of birds that are, and if you look at a map of North America, you'll notice that not only is Alaska north of much of North America, but it's also west of it. So a lot of birds that are migrating into the state, some come from Asia, some come up through the Pacific Ocean, but the land birds largely migrate in over the land and moving up over the North American continent. And many of those birds kind of go south to north in spring for quite a ways. But as they start approaching the latitudes for Alaska, they kind of hang a left, if you will, and move west into Alaska. And so obviously Gunsight Mountain isn't that far north of the Pacific Ocean. It's on the other side of some very substantial mountains from the Gulf of Alaska, but they're kind of moving west into probably southwestern Alaska or south central Alaska. And they're kind of following those intermountain trenches, avoiding the high mountains. And they're just moving along east to west in spring, moving back to where they're going to nest. Where they came from is highly variable depending upon the species. Many of these birds wintered in very southern Canada or the western states. Some of them, depending upon species and the individual, may have come from Mexico or even Central America. And they've moved up through western North America, possibly through the Great Plains or further west. And then they've moved up through Canada, probably avoiding the higher elevations in the Canadian Rockies and looking for those intermountain trenches. And then they've come in. Some really cool work with golden eagles is being done by Carol McIntyre near Nabesna. And there's quite a few golden eagles pouring through there in a trench not too far from Nabesna along the Nabesna River. Uh-huh. They're yep. probably coming into the state about Tok or whatever and maybe dropping southwest down along the Nabesna River going through Nabesna. And some of those birds may be connecting, dropping down into the Copper River Basin and moving through the Tazlina River up into the pass that Gunsight Mountain is in.
This is Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. We're talking about hawks and migration with Bob Dittrich and Ted Swam. Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Torlap. I'm talking with Ted Swam and Bob Dittrich about hawks and migration. Bob, how long has this hawk watch been going on for?
Well, I think we did some figuring the other day and figured that it started in 88. You know, we were probably doing our little social gatherings in the early 80s. And yeah. then 88 was the first official Anchorage Audubon hawk watch.
Huh. I might have been the first one. That's about the time I started going up there. That's sort of fun. Talk to us a little bit about numbers. I know it's difficult in one spot. I know a lot of birds are not doing so well. How's our raptor scene doing?
That's a very complex question. First of all, one of the things, well, there's two reasons why people are attracted. People who are studying hawks or interested in conservation of hawks are drawn to these migration sites. One is you can count birds, which gives you an index of their abundance, the total numbers in the populations of the different species. And theoretically, with enough counts at enough migration sites, you could document trends in populations. The second reason is in some of those places, you can trap and band birds. And now the telemetry or various devices that can be attached to the birds and track their movements, those devices are getting smaller and smaller, enabling scientists to track individual birds, possibly enough of them to understand movements and connectivity between where birds breed and where they migrate and winter, and getting insights that just can't be acquired in other ways. And so the species that are moving through gun sight. Most of them, I would say, are thought to be stable in their abundance and their status is healthy. Golden eagles continent-wide are declining. There's conservation concern for golden eagles. And so counting birds, where Carol McIntyre, who I mentioned earlier, is doing her work, and at Gunsight Mountain, where Hawkwatch International is now doing a standardized count for all raptors, but including goldens, may help us track trends in populations. There's some complications with that, though. When you're counting birds, you're getting what we'd call an index, or it's a sample. You're counting those individuals that you can see, and that just is going to include those individuals that are moving by close enough and low enough for you to detect them. And that is just a subset of the population of birds that is moving through that region. And the relationship between the number of birds seen and the total number of birds is very hard to determine. And that could also change with climatic conditions. If it gets warmer earlier in the spring, there could be more thermals and birds could be either migrating on different routes or migrating higher above the ground. And you would detect a smaller proportion of those birds going over if they're higher, some of them possibly too high to be seen with the human eye even. So in any event, a whole network of migration places across North America where they're counting numbers of birds is being employed to provide statistical analysis and track trends. So as a network, they're extremely useful, even though any individual place may not be perfect for discerning trends in populations. And again, many species of raptors were impacted by pesticides such as DDT and dieldrin decades ago. Now those birds have recovered. So peregrine falcons, merlins, ospreys, bald eagles, all four of those species were creamed by exposure to those pesticides, which affected survival rates and reproduction. Now most of those birds have recovered completely and are stable. We're probably most concerned for a few species such as short-eared owls, possibly northern harriers, and golden eagles currently, but you never know what humanity is going to throw in the way of wildlife.
Thank you, Ted. Thank you both for joining me. On the next part of the show, we're going to have a representative from Hawkwatch International at the Hawkwatch talking to us about what he does. And that's one of his long-term studies, correct?
When we were doing it, we were kind of haphazard and going up, you know, on the good days and on the some weekends. And it's nice that to get it standardized. Paul Fritz should get some credit for spending a couple years up there doing a lot of counting and trying to be more thorough about it. And then Hawkwatch International came in with some financial backing that allowed them to bring counters that could really do a good job.
We'll look forward to hearing from those guys right after a break. This is Outdoor Explorer in Alaska Public Media. We're talking about hawks and hawk migration with Ted Swim and Bob Dutrin. Thanks, guys, for being with me today.
It's been great.
Thank you.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Hi, it's Jen White, host of 1A, and you're listening to KSKA Anchorage, Alaska Public Media FM 91.1, connecting Alaskans, life, and form.
On Virginia's eastern shore, food is just a lot closer to the table.
If we wanted some steam crabs, we get on our bikes and we pedal 5 or 6 miles down to the creek, catch our crabs and come back. Nothing like frying a fresh soft crab on the stove.
I'm Sarah McConnell. Join me for With Good Reason.
This Friday at 8:30 p.m. on Alaska Public Media, FM 91.1 or alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm Tobin Shelby, the show's producer. Before we get back to Paul Twardock talking about Hawk Watch, we're going to take a small diversion, still staying with birds, though, and hear about the Great Backyard Bird Count, a day in mid-February when birders around the world venture out into their neighborhoods to count and record every bird they can spot. KUCB's Sophia Stewart-Rossi joined Unalaskans as they tallied their feathered friends.
It's a cold and windy winter day on Amaknak Island. Megan Dean is leading a group of local birders outside along Alulik Harbor. She's with the Museum of the Aleutians.
I know, between the wind and the sun, my eyes are like watering.
Dean is using binoculars looking out across the water. Soon she spots a group of black and white ducks. The birds are bobbing up and down on the waves, and they aren't that easy to identify because there are a lot of different black and white ducks in the Aleutian region. So knowing the fine details to separate them all becomes crucial. Dean has ID books and brochures to help participants in the group decipher what species the birds are.
I'm kind of more of like a pelican and flamingo girl. Like I want an odd-shaped, very large duck or bird.
That you need to identify?
Yeah.
The group ranges from toddlers to seniors. This one-day global bird count event helps scientists track bird populations just before their spring migration begins. It's a program run by Cornell Lab, Audubon Society, and Bird Studies Canada. Today, the Unalaska birders count 16 bird species, including four common ravens, which is exciting to see as their population has drastically decreased in the last couple of years for unknown reasons. But Dean was on the hunt for another bird today. She's looking for a canvasback duck, a species a fellow birder found earlier that day.
So it's like another Oreo duck.
Oh.
But it's a little more white than the Scots, and it's got a brown head, and it's got a different color beak and kind of a different shaped beak. It's more of like a Roman nose.
Once the birds are counted, Dean records the sightings in the eBird app so birders and scientists around the world can see what birds are hanging out in Unalaska on February 15th. For some places in the world, it's competitive.
Colombia, we learned, is currently in the count of counting the most birds.
Oh,
Interesting.
The results of Unalaska's Great Backyard Bird Count can be found at birdcount.org. In Unalaska, I'm Sophia Stewart-Rossi.
That was Sophia Stewart-Rossi from member station KUCB, and this is Outdoor Explorer. Up next, we'll hear more from Paul Twardock about Hawk Watch.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Twardock. Last April in 2024, I spent a beautiful weekend at Gunsight Mountain watching raptors migrate and talking with Sam Darmstead with Hawk Watch International. Our conversation is up next.
I'm out here at Hawk Watch by Gunsight Mountain on the Glen Highway, so we'll have some traffic noise going by once in a while. I'm here with Sam Darmstead.
Yeah, that's me.
Sam is out here with Hawk Watch International. Doing what, Sam? Tell us what you're doing out here.
We're counting migratory raptors. So we are out here at mile point 120, 7 days a week, from generally from 10 to 6, counting every migrating hawk, eagle, and falcon that comes through, identifying the species and recording their numbers.
So, and you've been here since March, right? And how long are you here for?
Yeah, we were here since March 10th. I'm actually leaving a little early. I'm leaving on May 4th, but the count goes until May 15th.
That's impressive. Every day, you guys are counting birds.
Well, between me and my coworker Andrew, we're out here every day, but we each get one day off per week that we stagger. So there's at least someone out here watching, and we don't get burnt out.
Yeah, and unfortunately, Andrew's not here today. So, and what's the, how long has Hawkwatch been doing this here in Alaska at this spot?
So there has been a long tradition of hawk watching up by Gunsight Mountain, but Hawkwatch International took over the count starting in 2016. And since then, they've been able to make it a little bit more standardized by hiring full-time counters for the whole season that are there from the very beginning to the very end to catch the entire migration through this corridor, especially in March during the peak golden eagle migration, which is it's of scientific interest by Alaska Department of Fish and Game to know what their populations are like in the state. And this migration count has helped inform on that.
Yeah, I know. In March, I was up by Talkeetna, and I saw my first golden eagle. And then I looked at your guys' count, and you had 60 come through in like one day.
Yeah, that was our biggest count of golden eagles for the season, and likely will be because they're already post-peak. But this is actually kind of a slower year for them. You know, it's not uncommon for most years to have several days with triple-digit counts of golden eagles in mid to late March or early April.
Huh, that's amazing. Why this spot here?
So we are kind of in a really big funnel made by some mountains. We have this valley, the Matsu Valley, kind of in between the Talkeetna and the Chugach Mountains, funnels the birds. And even though it's their spring migration and they've come north, some of them, you know, thousands of miles from southern United States, Mexico, Central America, they generally travel north into Alaska on the interior of the Coast Range and then kind of goes and skirt around the Wrangells and then head southwest through this corridor. And then when they leave, they'll disperse throughout the state and head to wherever they're going to nest. So this site was kind of discovered because of this unique geography that gives you a really high concentration of migrating birds in a relatively small area. So it's a good place to count as many as is possible without having to move around too much.
Yeah, you don't move around much. And we're pausing once in a while as we might see a bird, because Sam's got a job to do here. We don't want to miss one, but we're in a little bit of a lull right now, so that's working out. For listeners who aren't familiar with this area, it has got to be one of the more stunning spots on the road system anywhere. We've got the Chugach Mountains on one side, and then what do we got here? We got something, a bunch of swans, maybe?
Yeah, migrating tundra swans flying overhead.
Cool. How often do you see swans?
Pretty regularly. They kind of just started moving through this past week or so, but since then we've seen them most days. We're definitely getting more diversity in general with birds coming through in the non-raptor department as well, including songbirds and waterfowl.
Yeah, I think I was here on Saturday for the official sort of hawk watch tailgate party, and you said some swallows, is that right?
Yeah, we've had our first swallows were on Saturday, and we've seen them every day since.
It's such a cool thing for Alaskans. To me, it's like spring, right? It's like this amazing thing of birds sort of reappearing after a long, somewhat quiet winter.
Yeah, especially the ones that eat insects, like the violet-green swallows we've been seeing. It's like, okay, here, it's spring now, there's no going back.
And there's been a few of those insects out, right?
Yeah, we've seen some flies and moths and butterflies. We saw our first Milbert's tortoise shell maybe a week and a half ago.
So back to birds, what else have you been seeing here?
In terms of...
raptors and species, yeah.
We started out with looking at golden eagles, and then we also have bald eagles pretty regularly. Some of them migrate, some of them are just local to the area. And then we also, in the beginning of April and then through now, is kind of the window when we get some hawks moving through. So that starts with Harlan's red-tailed hawk, which is a subspecies that mostly just nests in Alaska. And then also rough-legged hawk. We've had sharp-shinned hawk and northern harrier. Those were also arrivals earlier in the month. And then merlin and peregrine falcon and American kestrel have been the falcons we've seen so far. We got our first merlins in March, which was pretty remarkable because that was the first time they've ever been seen in March at the Hawk Watch. And then we've seen some more since then. And we just had our first peregrine falcon yesterday, and then our second one today, and our first kestrels were on Saturday. And we've gotten American goshawks, which I've mentioned before. And yesterday we had our first Swainson's hawk, which is another in the genus Buteo, along with red-tailed hawk and rough-legged hawk. And they're a really special bird here. They're hard to find in Alaska, and this is kind of like the spot to see them. So a lot of people who want to see a Swainson's hawk in Alaska will come here in late April and early May to hope they get lucky and have one come through. And they're a really incredible species. They nest pretty widely in the western North America, but it's rare that they get this far north. And they are like one of the longest migrating species that we get here. So the one that we saw yesterday was likely wintering in the Argentine Pampas.
Oh, wow. That's a long commute.
Yeah, eating grasshoppers and spending its winter in the open grasslands there. And it traveled just about or nearly 10,000 miles to get here.
That's impressive. That's right up there with Arlette Tern. And some of these others, are they Central America? Like, where are they, like red tails and harlins and the rough legs?
A lot of them, especially the ones that we get, earlier tend to be ones that are wintering further north, which makes sense. So a lot of them, like the red tail and the harlins, are wintering in southern Canada and the lower 48, and then migrating up here. And then some, and that's generally the same with sharpshin. Some species that might be coming up here from Central America include northern harrier, and Swainson's hawk too comes a very long way. And then, as well as some of the peregrine falcons that we see, can also be traveling over 10,000 miles to get here.
Are there any, I don't know, I mean, it's probably too short term a study, but have you seen any trends or any changes from, since this has started?
There haven't been really enough years to say. One interesting finding is definitely that since Alaska Department of Fish and Game has been interested in the golden eagle migration, and there's been counters here every day during their peak, they've learned that there's more golden eagles in the state than they previously thought, which is great news just from there being full season counts here that have more individuals than there were previously thought to be golden eagles in the state. And then obviously there's more than that that don't come through here.
You don't probably worry too much about double counting individuals because they're just moving through, right?
Yeah, we do have to keep that in mind, definitely, especially if there's a bird that's moving slowly and we first detect it way out in front of us, and then maybe we'll see it, we'll detect it again behind us, and we'll think about whether or not it makes sense that it might be the same individual. Or we worry about having the local raptors that might be coming through or just on their daily hunting rounds, flying around the sky, and we definitely spend some time and effort thinking about whether or not a bird looks like it's migrating, or whether it acts like it's a local, or whether or not it's appearing at the same time and place that we've had a bird appear before might indicate that there's this one bird that has its certain rounds that it makes, and then we can like recognize that individual when we see it each day.
It's a bright sunny day, and you mentioned when I first showed up that it might be super high, and it's obviously it's a big sky, so it's possible to miss them. Any clue of what your success rate is?
It's hard to say. There's definitely some times when you feel humbled by like a bird that like you just barely get on. You're like, okay, I easily could have missed that one. But it's hard to have an idea of your success rate when you have no way of measuring it. You know, like if we knew how many birds we were missing, then that would be great, because then we would have a better idea of how many are coming through. But on a day like this, there's not a cloud in the sky. It's pretty warm. There's like likely very excellent thermals, and these birds could be well above the limit of our vision if just looking up and hoping to see them.
And I'm very impressed how good you guys are on Sunday seeing things, and I'd be like, what are they looking at? When you're looking, you know, for birds, are you just looking at species, or are you looking for gender at all, or any other sort of information you're trying to discern?
We take as much information as we feel we can confidently gather. So some birds you can safely tell the age or the sex, and some you can't. So if we are able to tell the age and sex of a bird, we'll record that down with that observation on our data recording software, which is Trektelen. And also with some of the birds that have different color morphs, so that's not related to age or sex, but there's some like red-tailed hawks and rough-legged hawks specifically have a light color morph and a dark color morph, and then a really wide range in between. So we do try, and also we can record data on whether or not it's light or dark, and there's lots of ones that are in between that kind of don't fit into either side. But when we can get that data down as well, we do that too.
This is Alaska Public Media. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Torlak. We're out here at Kunsight Mountain at about mile 121 or something like that. And we're talking with Sam with Hawk Watch International, talking about the Hawk Watch and the counts of birds out here. Sam, what have been some of your highlights this year?
Definitely that Swainson's hawk was a big highlight. You're not guaranteed to see one here. It's definitely like, it's not unexpected. People come here specifically to do that, but they're pretty rare, and it's nice to get those. Definitely having some really early Merlins was a big highlight. It's always nice to kind of expand on your knowledge of like when birds might come through in the variations. So like something like a Merlin they are migratory, but they can winter farther north than they might typically do. So then you might see them also migrating early. So kind of like expanding on those known windows when a bird might be moving is a really nice thing to have happen. I've been really just impressed with the northern harrier numbers. When people talk about this count, they talk a lot about certain species like rough-legged hawk, golden eagle, American goshawk, but I feel like northern harriers are kind of one of the unsung heroes. I think this is definitely the place where I've been that I've seen the most northern harriers in a day. It's just going to be pretty impressive to like be watching the sky and see like just a line of four or five moving through in like the span of a few seconds.
Give me an idea of the numbers that when you talk about a lot. Like, what's a lot?
Well, yesterday we saw 83 northern harriers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. We also had, I think our second highest count was 70, which is just, that's, you know, a lot of birds of one species to see moving through in a day here. And I think the average total season count for northern harriers, 355. So getting days like those, that's a significant proportion of the total flight happening on a single day.
And that's like an 8-hour day, right? Because it's been talking about, I mean, day up here right now. It's light at 5:30 a.m. It's dark at night, but you're just out here till work day, is that right?
Yeah, our general protocol is to count from 10 to 6. We do have weather interruptions that can change that. And if we're here at 6 and there's still a lot of birds flying, we'll extend the count to try and not miss too much. But if it's slowed down, you know, we'll leave at 6 p.m.
This is April 2024. We'll probably air this right before next year's in 25. What's the best weather to be out here? Besides nice sunny days for obviously comfort purposes, but what are the birds like?
That can be really hard to say. We've had some conditions that seemed like they would be good and just didn't deliver very many birds, and vice versa. Definitely for our comfort, we like it when it's warm and sunny. At the beginning of the season, you're definitely like wrapped in several layers, and it's not that case anymore. But generally, like, you know, the birds like it to be somewhat warm because then you get thermals and it makes it easier to fly. Having winds out of the northeast is nice because it gives them a tailwind when they're coming southwest through this corridor. For us, it can be nice to actually have some cloud cover at least, because it makes it a bit easier to spot the birds rather than against a big expanse of just blue sky.
Finally, what's next for you? Finish this and then what? Where do you head down to Homer, you said?
Yeah, well, I'm going to Homer to do some training with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, because I'm going to be spending the summer working with the nesting seabirds on St. Paul Island.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, working for the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
I'm really excited to do that. It's going to be a great summer.
You are like living the dream, dude.
Yeah, I like to think so.
Thanks to my guests Ted Swam and Bob Dutrill, and Hawkwatch International's staff Sam Darmstead. A special thanks to our producer Tobin Shelby, with additional help from Ammon Swenson. I'm your host Paul Twardock, and from all the hosts at Outdoor Explorer, keep an eye on the sky and we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite...
Aleutian Peninsula Broadcasting is generously supported by the City of Sandpoint. Sandpoint is a first-class city in the Aleutians East Borough, located on Humboldt Harbor on the northwestern Popoff Island. Anchorage is 575 nautical miles to the northeast. The Sandpoint City Council meets the second Tuesday of every month at 7 p.m. in the City Hall Council Chambers. Contact the City of Sandpoint by calling 907-383-2696, emailing sptcity@arctic.net, or visiting their website at sandpointak.com. KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint. K201DA 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS 88.1 FM in Fall.